Welcome to 3CR Radio.
Very happy to be here.
Vijay Prashad, how's your tour been with Redan so far?
Very interesting. This is my first time in Australia. I got to see a kangaroo. That was exciting. A kangaroo had a joey in her pouch. She didn't try to box us. She ran away. We also walked up to the federal parliament to watch the seagulls flying around. It was a miracle to see seagulls so far inland. You'll notice that I basically focused on nature. That was my presupposition of Australia before I came. But of course, met some remarkable people and learned a lot about the people's history of Australia. Just in like a week, I've learned a lot about people's struggles, you know, the Black Armada, the struggles to even build a little workers' solidarity park in Perth that basically, in one way, overlooks the world's most hideous corporations that are headquartered in Perth. So it's been a very instructive few days.
And how have you found people's reaction to you here? I mean, obviously, your talks were attempted. There was an attempted coup on your talks.
Well, there, people are welcome to say what they want about me, but I would hope that there would be some, you know, consistency and accuracy. Like, people were saying things to me that were news to me. That was interesting. I had to, in fact, Google several words to understand exactly what was being said. Look, frankly, I'm all for dialogue and discussion. If people are not interested in some formulations that people like myself have, that's fine. They are not being forced into them. Have a discussion. What was quite crazy was the statement, letter, whatever you call it, if you read it out, would have taken longer than the talks that I made. So, you know, people could have come and asked focused questions or whatever. Indeed, in New Zealand, where I was before, people did come and ask some of the questions that had been raised in that text. And I answered as best as I could. But to be honest with you, some of them were quite strange, you know. And I felt them also to be based on a kind of sense of the world that I don't really inhabit. Obviously, people see the world differently. You know, I've been, you know, within the Palestinian struggle since the 1980s, much before many of the people who wrote that text were born. You know, I've been with the BDS movement, Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement from 2004. I was on the framing committee for the academic and cultural boycott. So, you know, my bona fides don't have to be explained. I feel embarrassed even saying these things. And for people to say, well, he should be cancelled because we don't agree with everything he says. You know, frankly, I believe in a lot of things. But I'm certainly a very clear supporter of the Palestinian right to justice and determination of one kind or the other. So I didn't appreciate that part of my bona fides being challenged, frankly. Of all the things, that part of it I felt was slightly unethical, given the fact that we are all fighting against a genocide and that many forces are trying to delegitimize us while we are fighting to end this genocide.
And okay, so taking that as a jump-off point to address issues within movements globally of people being more focused on drama and than actual solidarity work or than actual intellectualism of any sort.
Yeah, I mean, what can one say? You know, I don't want to characterize anybody's politics as drama, you know, because I would like to believe that they are sincere, that they hold to certain positions, and so on. That's what I would like to believe. On the other hand, I'm a person who believes that the politics of justice and progress, human progress, should be based in facts. And, you know, why do I so fervently believe in the cause of the Palestinians for justice? It's not a romantic belief. I believe that colonization is absolutely the opposite of justice. I believe that the decolonization struggle is one of the imperatives in our world today. When I was younger, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement alongside the movement for justice for the Palestinians, because these were some of the decolonization struggles that had been incomplete. You know, I've been, ever since I learned about it, very strongly in favor of the Sahrawi people's resistance against, you know, first Spanish and then Moroccan colonization. So, you know, I mean, this is not an issue of drama versus reality. This is an issue of build your politics from the facts and have a sense of engagement with people with whom you basically agree, but you might have some differences with them. I mean, the real question I would ask to anybody who was so perplexed, you know, by my presence in Australia is, am I your main problem?
Mm. It's the 80-20 thing for me, yeah? If we agree on 80% of all things, then the 20 is dialectics and we can work that shit out.
I suppose so. You're right. It's something like that. But also, it's a matter of perspective. You know, lots of people come to places like Australia and New Zealand, you know, from they get funded by US institutions, they get grants from US foundations. I don't think I have missed it, but I'm not sure people have written long letters denouncing these professors for taking money from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Open Society Foundation. You know, these are groups, including the Oppenheimer Foundation in South Africa. These are groups that have actively participated in genocidal activity against, you know, minority peoples at the mine mouth and so on. But taking money from them somehow is completely acceptable and gives you a free pass. So I don't understand, I really don't understand the sense of proportion or disproportion in this. Why is it that, you know, professors from Western universities are welcomed with open arms in Australia? Is it to do with Eurocentrism? Is it that when you are confronted with the journey of a person who doesn't have a university job but works as a journalist, to earn his living and runs a research institute whose probably political line you don't like, is that open game? Isn't this a form of strangely Eurocentrism to not attack the European professor but to attack the Indian who lives in Chile and comes on a tour for the first time to Australia, whom you've never met and probably never read?
And what more of this critique of like a perfect, in scare quotes, left, where it comes from this like comfortability in being in a impotent marginality rather than becoming or working towards an active majority, an active solidarity majority internationally?
You know, it's an interesting thing because during this Israeli bombardment of the Palestinians in Gaza, West Bank, then the Lebanese and so on, during this period, 14 factions of the Palestinian struggle with very, very different political attitudes to the world, different social attitudes to the world. The gap between Hamas and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine could not be wider in terms of their social perspective of the world. Yet, these 14 groups came together in Beijing, they signed an accord, they agreed to work together, and so on. They understand the importance at this moment of unity. If they, who are facing a genocidal bombardment, can put unity ahead of sectarianism, why can't the solidarity movement do the same? I'm not saying suspend all argumentation forever, but we are in the middle of a very difficult period when our friends are being killed. I've lost personal friends in Gaza. I've been to Gaza, traveled there, stayed in people's homes. Some of them have died. The 14 Palestinian factions didn't continue to persist with their infighting or their differences, their principal differences on political and social issues. They suspended it for the purpose of the unity in the struggle against Israeli genocide and apartheid. Why can't the solidarity movement emulate the unities put forward by the Palestinian factions?
And act in solidarity with them. I mean, Leila Khaled said, yeah, look, we couldn't be further away from Hamas, but right now we're under an existential threat.
Yeah, well, what's the difference right now between somebody from Hamas and somebody from the PFLP or Fatah or whatever? You know, when a bomb falls, it's not like some special bomb that only kills Hamas. It's been killing civilians, it kills everybody. You have to unite to fight against that. Your differences can be dealt with later. There will be time, if there is time, because it is something of an existential threat. I mean, look, frankly, in the international solidarity movement, I get that there are differences of opinion. People are frustrated, they are angry, they are feeling demoralized. they are perhaps even feeling like their work is not doing anything. There are all kinds of debates about tactics. Should we do direct action? Should we do mass mobilization? I get that people are frustrated, but frustration should never make people who believe in the same objective turn on each other. You know, that's not what you should do to your frustration. You know, you can't turn on each other. That's, you are doing the work then, basically, of Israeli intelligence. Because you're turning on each other, you're breaking our unities, you're weakening us, you're making us less focused on the objective. You know, on tactical grounds, if somebody wants to do direct action, go and do it. Somebody else wants to build mass mobilization, go and do it. There's no need to fight on that basis, you know. What's the point of somebody who believes in direct action attacking somebody who believes mass mobilization? We need all fronts. I would like to see artists draw pictures, cartoons, poets write poetry. A mass cultural struggle against this genocide. That's necessary. Not sectarianism. You know, this is the correct way, the only way. Not just the correct way, the only way. That's a wrong attitude.
And that's what, it's funny you say that, because that's what the Palestinian resistance faction as a united front have said. They've called for unity on all fronts, is what they call it, an attack from all cultural aspects, all social aspects, any sectarian politics, and that's really a call to action to all of us. In saying that, how necessary is it right now to shape an understanding of imperialism and how it affects our day-to-day lives and have that shape our principles therein?
I mean, frankly, I think it's very important to have an accurate, fact-based understanding of imperialism today, because people are not always clear on what's happening. For instance, this debate has continued for decades. You know, does the United States direct Israel, or is Israel directing the United States? In fact, this is an absolutely worthless debate, because the true thing is that the United States and Israel operate hand in glove. Doesn't matter who's calling the shots at which exact moment. They operate hand in glove. They are basically one country. You know, the other day there was a vote in the UN General Assembly on the blockade of Cuba, 187-2. I said after that, no, that's a wrong number. In fact, it's 187-1, because Israel and the US is one. They always vote the same. So why give them the you know, the kind of the, you know, lifting them up and saying they have two votes? Don't give them that space. Just say it's 187-1. Who's the one? United States of America plus Israel. Mm-hmm. They are one. They are not two. In that sense, we have to understand, what is imperialism? This is an imperialist attack on the Palestinians. It's the United States plus Israel. See, there are a lot of people who believe that there are multiple imperialisms, all this stuff. Okay, fine, show me. Tell me how. What is, for instance, the Russians have done that's imperialist? The Russians invaded Ukraine. But many countries invade other countries. You know, Rwanda invaded Mozambique. We don't consider Rwanda an imperialist country. These things happen. You know, Indonesia invaded West Papua. That's not imperialism. That's aggression. That's annexation of territory. But it's not imperialism. You know, Vietnam invaded Cambodia. Not imperialism. They entered Cambodia to end the killing fields. Cuba, quote-unquote, invaded Angola. In fact, they entered Angola to participate in a war to destroy the South African apartheid army. The entry of troops across border is not imperialism. It's an act of perhaps aggression, but it's not imperialism. That's a facile thing. Imperialism, much more complicated system. The United States has 900 military bases around the world, 400 of them in the Pacific Ocean, several of them on the Australian landmass. It is ridiculous not to see the massive military imbalance between the United States and its close allies, including Israel, and large countries such as China, India, Indonesia, Russia, and so on. Those countries don't have that kind of military mind. The United States has the 5 to 11 eyes intelligence network. These countries don't have that. The United States has the G7, the coordinating body for economic and political policy among its closest allies. China doesn't have that. The Russians don't have that. The United States and the global north are a bloc. They are a military bloc, a military alliance, in fact, through NATO. The global south, the BRICS, these are not alliances. These are projects. BRICS is a project. The Chinese do not have ambitions to go and take over the rest of the world. They are not interested in invading Australia building military bases. They're not interested. That's not what they're doing. People say, well, you know, look how they treated Hong Kong. Excuse me. Hong Kong was stolen from China by the British in a colonial adventure, which China waited patiently for Hong Kong's lease to end so that it brings it back into the Chinese territory. You know, India didn't wait for the lease. There was no lease in Goa, Daman and Diu in Western India held by the Portuguese. The Indian army in the 1960s entered and seized it. You know, the Chinese have not seized Hong Kong. They have not seized Taiwan. You know, until the 1970s, Taiwan's government, based in Taipei, used to say there's one China, Taipei is the capital. After the 1970s, the United Nations recognized the People's Republic of China, and then they just said one China, Beijing is the capital. The Kuomintang has never said there's two Chinas. They also say there's one China. So I don't get how people in places like Australia say, well, Taiwan is an independent country. Even half the Taiwanese population that vote for the Kuomintang vote for a political force that says there's one China. Where the conflict lies is what's the capital. But these people aren't saying there's an independent Taiwan. So it's crazy, this idea that China wants to annex the world. It's not trying to annex the world. It's trying to establish its territory over places that it thinks are part of China.
And how much do you think that people that espouse thoughts of Russian imperialism or Chinese imperialism, in quotes, and put them against US imperialism, are they being naive, intellectually disingenuous, or part of a controlled opposition?
Well, firstly, it's a dangerous way to view the world. You know, let's take a stupid analogy. If there's a playground bully, and this playground bully is terrorizing everybody, and somebody shows up and says, well, that's one playground bully, but there are also two others who are, in fact, trying to defend some of the other people there. And you say, well, you know, let's live with the playground bullies because, you know, now there's a balance of playground bullies, and just normalize that situation. That's very troubling because then the rest of the kids are going to forever be terrorized by this playground bully. Why normalize the most dangerous military force in the world? You know, the Chinese did not go and destroy Iraq. The Chinese didn't destroy Afghanistan. The Chinese didn't go and destroy Libya. The Chinese haven't gone and bombed significant parts of Latin America or overthrown their government in coup d'etats. The Chinese didn't do any of this. The Russians didn't do any of this. I mean, the Russian war in Ukraine is nothing compared to the Israeli bombardment of Gaza. If the Russian war in Ukraine was comparable, there would be images all over the world, internet, TV, whatever, showing this ghastly bombardment of entire neighborhoods. I mean, it's not happening. They're not bombing, Ukraine like the Israelis and the Americans are bombing Gaza. These are apples and oranges, or in fact, not even that. These are apples and stones. It's a completely different thing. One is a war. The other is a genocide. If I was to call what happened to Iraq with clarity, it was illegal invasion of Iraq, which became genocidal. I mean, 30,000 people were killed in Mosul when the US went and bombed it to send ISIS out of the city. 30,000 people. We've forgotten that. You know, maybe 2 million Iraqis died in that entire period. Forgotten. Almost every Iraqi that I know, because I was reporting the war, has somebody who died or has been injured.
When you hear reports from that era, especially from Iraqis, it sounds eerily familiar to what Palestinians are reporting on the ground now. Bombs, schools targeted, mass killings of people that are just in civilian areas.
There's a big difference. Let's take the bombing of Mosul, which was toward the end of the US bombardment, real nasty bombardment of the country. Mosul is a city, but it's surrounded by a countryside. When the US started to bomb Mosul, lots of people fled into the fields. And they were therefore protected because nobody was bombing the fields. In Gaza, there's nowhere to run. So you are basically a sitting target. Even if you survive, you are traumatized for a very long time because you don't know when the bomb is going to fall. You know, we are sitting in a very nice apartment in Perth. You know, if a bomb falls and breaks that section of the apartment building over there, there's no guarantee that 2 seconds later a bomb is not going to fall here. We can't even see the plane. We can't even hear it. There's so much noise. you know, we can't run. Like right now we're sitting in the veranda. We could jump over here, break our legs, and crawl into the wood over there. But in Gaza, there's no place to run. You're stuck, man. You can't jump off a building. What will you crawl past? There's rubble everywhere. So the one difference is that people are sitting ducks in Gaza. In Iraq, they were not. They could actually flee into the countryside, to villages, and so on. In Gaza, there is nowhere to flee. In Ukraine, people are fleeing. They're all going abroad. So many of them going to get jobs in Spain. Nobody wants to fight in the war. Their conscription has not worked really well. People don't want to fight in Ukraine anymore.
And the Russian front smashed through any integrity that the Ukrainians could hold. So that conflict's effectively over, especially with Trump saying that he'll turn off the tap should he get elected. Yeah.
I don't know, man. I mean, you know, frankly, I think this could have been prevented long before. For Tricontinental, I wrote a newsletter documenting how in the months before February 2022, the Russians put a series of proposals to the Americans on the table saying, look, we need a security guarantee. There will be no US nuclear mid-range missiles in Ukraine. There will be no joining NATO for Ukraine. These were security positions they wanted to negotiate. The US just completely rejected all of them. The US has become rejectionist when it feels like it. So for instance, it was the US that in 2019 withdrew from the Intermediate Forces Nuclear Treaty. You know, a hard fought treaty to negotiate. You leave the INF Treaty in 2019, and then the Russians say, if you're not in the INF Treaty, we are afraid you're going to place missiles into Lithuania or into Ukraine. I mean, the Germans right now are building a military base. The Wehrmacht, same name, is building a military base in Lithuania for 4,000 German troops. You're going to see for the first time German troops deployed in a base outside Germany. German troops had been there supporting role in Afghanistan and so on. But they're going to be in a base in Lithuania on the Russian border. Now the fear is the Americans might use that base to place mid-range nuclear missiles. This is why Russia entered that conflict. It didn't enter the conflict necessarily to take land, you know, but now we're at a different period. Russia is probably not going to bargain away the Donbass region. You know, probably not. I don't know. It's likely that other territorial gains are part of the negotiation. Like they may give up Mariupol. I don't know. It's likely they want a land bridge to Crimea. You know, now it's too late. They've taken this territory. How are you going to bargain them down on that? I don't see it. I see a position now that unless the West pumps in more weapon systems into Ukraine, and which can really hit Russian targets, I think Ukraine is going to have to now live with this crescent from the Donbass down to Crimea in Russia, and then have integrity to hold the rest of the country of their own. Make concessions, no NATO, maybe they'll be allowed to join NATO, but no intermediate missiles. I don't know.
And how do we take a lesson from this in terms of Australia being now slowly over time positioned to almost affect a similar position towards China and Taiwan, where we will be the main buffer between an escalating tensions between America and China?
I mean, we are talking in Perth in Western Australia. Just south of us in Exmouth is a major communications and telecommunications base for submarines, but also they are planning for deep space. Just north of us, as you go up, there are submarine stations. Out maybe several hours to our west is Pine Gap, major radar installation, a part of the Five Eyes Triangle. Then you go north of there, Tyndall Air Base being expanded for B-52 and B-1 American nuclear bombers. Is this going to bring Australia safety? I mean, why do you want to put a target on your country? If the Americans decide to attack Beijing, if they put mid-range missiles in Taiwan and hit Beijing, you know, 8 minutes, 10 minutes flight time, the Chinese are going to hit Western Australia. And that means that you're going to go into a war with your closest ally. In terms of closest ally who? Not in terms of politics or military, but in terms of trade. That's your biggest trading partner. What's going to happen to the Australian economy? Do you think the Americans are going to win a war against China. The Americans can destroy a bunch of Chinese cities. That is their capability. But will they win a war against China? No way. And do you want a big missile to land somewhere in downtown Perth? No.
There'll be none left.
We don't want that. Nobody wants that. The Chinese don't want it. The Chinese don't want escalation. Why would Australia, makes no sense. Why would Australia want to antagonize its major trading partner? Why?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes this in lieu of a political class that is completely bereft of any morals or politics. There's no like neoliberal project or social democratic project. There's just this faceless lobbying of securing your private home in the beach, and that's about it.
What is that? I mean, you know, end of the day, yesterday, walking in parts of Perth, you see all these, the world's top number one and number two mineral and metals mining companies. BHP number one and Rio Tinto number two. They have a project. They have an agenda. They do 20-year planning. They know what's going on. They are not idiots. Yeah, it seems that they know what's going on, but the parliament, whether in Western Australia or in the federal parliament in Canberra, is not able to tell the people what its project is. These companies have a project. I mean, interestingly, one could only hope that these companies will see the unreason in some of these moves towards war. Like, will it benefit BHP and Rio Tinto for Australia to participate in a war with China? Is that going to be used? I don't think so. They're doing well as it is.
They're not going to be able to extract any more resources, or it'll affect their bottom line.
I mean, I don't know. I just think there's a level of illogic in this, you know, that the major class that is benefiting from extraction, how will a war increase your bottom line? You're already making enormous amounts of money. You're already in a pretty comfortable way. There's no challenge to you. There is really no Australian challenge to the kind of control that the Australian minerals and metals companies have and their subsidiaries.
There's only a mass capitulation. Like, you know, here from a social perspective, mining companies, maybe some people might admit to their ills or something, but more or less it's viewed as like an escape scheme, you know, like do your time in the mines and then come back, buy your house, have a nice family, and that's it.
I'm not even thinking about the miners, man, because they have very few opportunities to resist. I'm thinking about society, you know, in general. I mean, the ancillaries, the this, the that, there seems to be no anti-mining, you know, I don't mean anti-mining, I mean anti-mining company, you know, politics. So if you are a mining company, there's no threat to you. You are making money trading with China. Why would you want an escalation to war? That seems illogical to me. Now, okay, so forget my logic. There is an escalation to war. Is it merely that the people who work at the top of the mining companies have a sort of racist feeling that how dare China dictate the terms? We should be dictating the terms to them. You know, we executives of mining companies should be showing up in Beijing and they should be touching our feet, not the reverse. Maybe there's some of this racial politics involved, but how do I know? I have not yet had a chance to meet any of these executives. I welcome a discussion with any executive from a mining company. I would like to get to know them.
Mm-hmm. It's the minds of darkness there. So in that, like a Chinese cultural opposition, how do you view, like, I mean, in Australia particularly, it's been increasing this cynical care of the Xinjiang region and Uyghur genocide and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, there's some claims that were even leveled at you towards that. Question be twofold, like, okay, what would be a tangible way to critique Chinese internal policy if you even needed to? And then, like, what are the actual tangible effects of people absorbing this sort of propaganda uncritically?
I mean, look, firstly, I don't take instructions from governments like the Australian government. You know, they are running a concentration camp in Manaus Island for people who are trying to migrate here, working class people, climate refugees. The Australian government gives full support to its mining companies when they operate in Papua New Guinea or they operate in Africa, Latin America, and so on. I mean, I've done stories of these companies and the hideous crimes that they commit elsewhere to masses of population, displacement, extermination of people. I mean, we are sitting in Western Australia, where the man who so-called discovered the northern part of this province, Mr. Forrest, exterminated native people who lived there. So, I mean, this country has no grounds to give any lectures to anybody about, you know, treatment of people. I mean, where is the stolen generation's justice? You know, these people don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to morality. You know, they have an easy time criticizing other countries. What about here? I mean, I looked around and saw what is these kind of left formations in Australia so worried about Xinjiang. What have they been doing about the stolen generation? Children of the stolen generation are living on the streets in Sydney, in Melbourne, you know, in the northern parts of the country. They have no future in front of them. I met a man in Sydney. He's painting on the walls. I had a nice conversation with him. He told me, I'm from the stolen generation. I don't want us to be forgotten. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, write about me. You know, where are the people in Australia who are fighting for them? They are worried about Xinjiang. That's interesting. You can worry about Xinjiang. But first, build your own house. You know, clean your own streets. Now, what is there in Xinjiang that is so upsetting you? The Chinese haven't done what, you know, the Americans did in Afghanistan or what the Russians did in Chechnya. They didn't come and just bomb Urumqi. In fact, Urumqi is unscathed. There was a series of bombings, terrorist actions in that part of the world, led by people who now live in Idlib, Syria. They don't even live in Xinjiang province. And by the way, the name of the province is Xinjiang Uyghur province. So the Uyghurs are not being genocided. They're in the name of the province. It's true that they've taken out people who they think are overly radicalized by a certain form of Islam. They take them to these places. They basically give them an option to re-educate or get out of the country. And people have been there. They are studying whatever different ideas of Islam and so on. Now, I don't want to deal with a problem like that. I would prefer to have clean hands, you know. But this is a real problem the Chinese government has to face. People are blowing up civilian areas in the country. There is no mass sentiment for secession in that part of the world. What do you do? You know, do you just let people blow things up, go out there, preach all kinds of radical ideas, or do you do something? They didn't want to kill everybody. They didn't want to put everybody in jail permanently like a Guantanamo. These are not options that the Chinese exercise. They did another thing, bring people in, put them in these places and hold seminars or whatever. Now, you can have a criticism of that, but is that genocide? I don't think so. I mean, we also have to have a good, honest discussion about what is a genocide. I mean, what's happening in Palestine is a genocide. 50, 60,000 people dead. Nobody has made number claims like that for Xinjiang. You know, 300 disappeared. What, this is meaningless, frankly. It's not serious, you know. It's not a serious criticism of the situation in China. You know, what do people want? They want to make a whole bunch of Israels around the world, only Uyghur province in Xinjiang, and only Kashmir, for only Kashmiris, that's Israel. You want to make a million Israels? Not my politics. I want to live in a plurinational society. I want to work to build rights for everybody. You know, if people in Australia believe so much in that, you know, Han colonization, so-called, has to end in China, well, then let them all go home to England and wherever they came from and give the land back to the Aboriginal people.
Yeah, I mean, here especially, I spoke to one professor that spent his whole life, Professor Jerry Georgiadis, spent his whole life researching a lot of things, but especially Indigenous suicide rates, and that 40% of the Indigenous population here are, especially in the state of WA, are below the poverty line, and 100% of suicides come from that. So there are deep, it's, you know, one thing, yeah, of course, addressing the historical ills, which aren't that far, that would be your generation for the stolen generation, but it's the continuing youth detention. I mean, in the Northern Territory, they just dropped the age to 10. The carceral age is now 10 years old.
So, I mean, that's crazy, you know. I mean, you tell me that you'd put a 10-year-old kid in jail and just sort of throw away the key, you know, and say that that is not a genocidal situation, you know, where there's been an active attempt to erase the Aboriginal people. That is not a genocidal situation. But what's genocidal is having to deal with a group that has been actually killing people for a project which nobody believes in. I'm against armed violence unless there is some massive sentiment and massive repression. You know, where is the attempt to build a politics in that region? You know, now in Xinjiang, you know, the standard of living has risen as a consequence of the abolition of absolute poverty. It's not paradise. Nowhere is paradise. But it's certainly not the same as Israeli bombs falling on 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, something that strikes me about this is this rolling out of the term genocide seems almost, I don't know, like an institutional tool. Because really you spend more time defining what is and what isn't, what qualifies, when really there's killing happening on the ground and that's all that should matter. And all these other sort of talks of semantics kind of distract from the real issues, which is, if you, like you just said, if you just interact with the issue, you'd probably find out more than what you want to know or whatever.
And there's a UN Convention Against Genocide. Just read the text. You don't need to debate what is or isn't. Read the text, see if a certain reality fits with the text. The problem is people cherry pick these texts. It talks about an attack on culture, but an attack on culture is not sufficient to raise it to the level of genocide. You know, look, culture has changed always and has mutated always. You know, was the introduction of English by the British in India a genocide, cultural genocide? I don't think so. You know, our cultural traditions are intact. Most of us added English to our language. We have all these other languages and English. Is it a cultural genocide? I think that's going too far. You know, that's also claiming too much for the natural process in human history of violence and the establishment of new cultures. You know, there's a lot of violence in the world. All violence isn't genocide.
And this thought of, like, especially within the left, of creating these sorts of, I don't know, ideological monoliths in your head that you have to debate and, you know, scratch your chin about, and rather than do actual action. It struck me yesterday in your talk that you said Marxism is a process, is an action. It's an action thing. It's not a perfect formula, and that there's a legitimate critique to be within the revolution, within doing something better, not outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're committed to building something, you will learn new habits. You know, people who fight to build things build habits of patience as well, you know, and care and concern. People have different skills. How do you amalgamate people into a project and so on? It teaches you a lot to be involved. When you're not involved, and then you're basically sitting at a computer and firing off, you know, your insults at people, it's much easier to be impatient. You know, patience is something that is learned. It's learned through struggle. And revolutionary patience is a very high ethic for people of the left.
And how much of this comes in this culture now of kind of co-opted identity politics, this thought of intersectionality and this sort of like, well, I'm of said affected marginalized category, yet I'm devoid of politics, and so therefore just by virtue of me being of that genocided place or affected place, then my voice is worth tenfold rather than my politics matching.
Well, firstly, oppression is real and people suffer oppression. But there has been a kind of unfortunate, you know, rebalancing of scales in the last 50 odd years. You know, exploitation is also a hideous form of human life, you know, where workers sell their labor to a boss, and then the boss basically eats the social wealth produced and gives a tiny amount back as wages. That's exploitation. Exploitation is a hideous form of social life. But over the last 50 years, we've elevated social oppression as a more hideous form of social life than exploitation, and talked about this binary between class and identity. Firstly, there is no binary. Because most people who are workers have identities of different kinds. You know, there are black workers, there are women workers, there are workers with a range of identities, you know. And so it's not the case that class and identity are counterposed. But what has been counterposed is that oppression is seen as a much greater harm or injury than exploitation. And I think that is unfortunate, because that has then created a politics of recognition over a politics of transformation, that I would like to be recognized for who I am. It's important to recognize people for who they are. It's important to fight oppression. But I think this imbalance between oppression and exploitation has really hurt the movements of the left, because, you know, the centrality and importance of class struggle has been set aside. Now, again, I don't want to be interpreted as saying that class is more important than identity, because this falls into a trap we didn't set. We didn't say there's a dichotomy between class and... I think these are braided forms, that oppression and exploitation are braided forms. They can't be seen as a binary, where then oppression is much more harmful than exploitation. These are braided. One has to tackle both. But unfortunately now, the braid of exploitation has slipped away, and the braid of oppression remains in play. And people then put oppression ahead of exploitation, and then it becomes about who you are rather than where you are in a structure and what you're fighting to transform.
It's an interesting narrative, because it plays into people's sense of individuality, and then as you're increasingly alienated from social settings or work, or then it's just easier to fold back on yourself and to give yourself excuses and to cover yourself with this sort of like, oh well, all these things must be real because they're true. But really, I mean, this is personal opinion, it's more about the fruit you bear, not the soil you come from. That's the importance to a struggle or to the world or to yourself even.
The great American philosophers, Eric B. and Rakim, it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. And I've always thought that that's a great line, you know. But, you know, the thing is, Eric B. and Rakim had an incomplete formulation, because it is also to some extent where you're from that matters. Where you're at is not necessarily only about, is not a binary away from where you're from. Where you're from matters, but where you're at is where you're struggling, you know, and how you put things. So I really believe in this braided, complex of identity and class as a braided idea. But I think it's very unfortunate that identity has superseded class, as if it's a binary and then a hierarchy.
And how do you move beyond that? If you'd have some advice to someone that's coming at a crossroads and realizing the limiting thought of this sort of happy individual, identity-based psyop that they've probably become subjected to via social media or via whatever forms of discourse are available to them, is there books you'd recommend to them? Or?
No, not books. What I recommend to people is go to a union demonstration. Go meet a trade unionist. Go meet a worker. You know, I mean, go and meet people who are in the active part of the working class. Go talk to them about what their views are. You might be surprised. I mean, there has been a real break between a lot of solidarity movements and the politics of unions. People may welcome unions to demonstrations, but are they going and talking to the workers? The advanced sections of the working class have their own ideas, you know. Talk to them. Build social relations with people. You know, students themselves can't change the world. No student demonstration has changed the world. It's a combination of students, workers, other oppressed people. That's what builds our left movement. Can't build a whole left based on student politics.
And that's the point of moving from saying solidarity to doing solidarity.
Yeah, doing solidarity is about building friendships, frankly. And I mean, you know, I'll give you an example. Most people who got involved in Palestinian solidarity work 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago did it by meeting somebody from the Palestinian diaspora, going to their house, becoming friends, knowing their children, eating the food, talking, building. You know, it's friendship is a very important part of left politics, you know, building long-term friendships. This is not something that I'm just saying in a romantic way. Friendship is the root of what keeps us going. And if you're not friends with people from the various sections that are in struggle with you, if you're just having an abstract relationship with workers or with Palestinians or whatever, then you're not building a politics, you're not improving yourself.
It's a theoretical exercise. You're interacting with a concept and not a person.
And you're not improving yourself. That's the key thing. You know, to have various understandings of different people's lives, you need to let it become part of you. It can't become part of you from a book.
It has to be through what these people love, lived experience, yeah? But they have to actually do it. In saying that, have you seen this maybe not as a judgment, but as a critique that opens the door of an international, I'm probably asking more towards about here, obviously you went to one Palestine rally, but as a, like the missing point of the missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle has been this integration of union politics into Palestine solidarity, one understanding the other, whether it's one, you know, talking about the other not being enough or something, where something about meeting people where they're at rather than where you'd want them to be.
Well, I mean, that's something imposed on you because people are where they are. I mean, you unless you sit at home and you have imaginary friends, people are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are and you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. You know, friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together. Yeah? So politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person, terrible. They haven't grown. They haven't shaped themselves. Haven't become a different, better person.
And I'm conscious that you have to go to lunch and that you're soon to give a talk. But I guess as a closing us off, like, what do you do in the Tricontinental Institute? What do you, and where can people find it? And how can people keep updated with what you have?
Yeah, I mean, the website is simple enough. It's thetricontinental.org. It's pretty simple, material in several languages. I produce with the team a weekly newsletter. It's about 1,000-1,200 words, goes out to about 1.5 million people, comes every week on Thursday in English, has new paintings, always paintings, which I love, some poetry. Every month we produce a dossier. This month we produced a dossier written by Professor Wang Hui of Tsinghua University. Next month we have one on the idea of corruption, a critique of the idea of corruption. We do a lot of research work in and around political movements, and that's our bread and butter, as it were. But also we have discussions with movements to try to learn how to frame their understanding of the world and so on. What do? I'm basically a journalist. I like to tell, I like to collect stories and tell them. You know, storytelling is the greatest part of being human. You know, maybe animals can do it as well. I don't know. I don't speak their language. But humans love to tell each other stories. And in a way, you know, that's what we've been doing for this period.
Mm-hmm. And you've got some books coming out as well recently.
Yes, I have a book that I wrote with Noam Chomsky called On Cuba, which is basically a very short 100 and some page account for people who have not been involved in the Cuba struggle to get to know about why Cuba is such an important beacon for revolutionary struggles around the world. And I'm sort of doing a book now called 10 Days That Shook My World, which is 10 novels that I really love. The first, I published recently, extract from the first essay, which is on Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. Unfortunately, in the 10 books, novels mainly, no Australian authors, but maybe in the 20, yeah. Who knows?
And I actually was struck by something that you said last night in regards to how you approach writing, that you approach it with a reader focus rather than like a theory focused something, you know, like you want the person to enjoy what they're reading should they come from any walk of life, or you said first book they ever read.
Well, because I like conversations. I want the person who's reading what I'm writing to be in conversation with me, to feel not intimidated by the book, but that they can talk back to me. Maybe that's why people write petitions against me. They feel they can talk back to me. And that maybe now thinking about it, I feel honored that there's petitions. Maybe they feel intimidated by professors whose books they can't understand. So maybe that's a good way to understand these petitions and attacks. Bring it on, guys, because that means we're in conversation.
Right, active dialectics.
Maybe.
But maybe do it in person. Yeah, this was one of my points that I thought was, if all these people have so much to say, then let them come to the talk and maybe ask a question.
Sometimes they can be disruptive. It's okay. We can do it in different ways.
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
It's a pleasure.